Darn. Well, thank you. As I sort of hesitate coming up here, you notice me, I'm stepping up looking for the step. The step is gone. Maybe it was never there. But, you know, usually I don't like to talk from a pulpit or a podium. I guess it's from experience of many years ago when I was in the parish in Stockton. I was asked to go substitute at the Catholic high school for a teacher who was ill. And, you know, those good Catholic boys, they figure things out in a hurry. As soon as it dawned on them, I couldn't tell what was going on past the first row. They were going out the window in the back of the classroom. So after that, if I substituted, it was always on the second floor with no fire escape. So this morning, I want to talk a bit about the subject of the Appendix 2. Is God a person? And I think what struck me most of all is Francis' experience, what I call his Jesus experience. We don't know a lot of detail about it. Something happened with the war with Perugia. He was imprisoned, had some kind of conversion experience there. Things changed after that. But we don't know too much about it. There's not a lot of details. But you know, that's true, I think, of all the Jesus experiences. At least that I've experienced a couple of weeks ago, or more than that now. We took a trip, our annual trip up north to see friends and relatives in the Stockton, Sacramento area, and then go up to Humboldt County. And one of our favorite stops is at the Redwood Monastery, the Trappistine Monastery in southern Humboldt. Well, this time we had the chance to stay there for a couple of days and nights. And in the afternoon, I was sitting there in the little room listening to a tape, and then I just put it away and I just sat. And you know, to me, there's a dynamism that goes on like at when we do communal meditation. The dynamism in that monastery, of course, with the silence and the peace, just sitting there, I just felt like something drew me out of myself. You know, to meditate wasn't the struggle of hauling in the runaway imagination, bringing the thoughts back to the subject, whatever the struggle is from day to day, that all left. There was just something that drew me out of myself, and that's all I can say about it. If you've experienced it, you know what we're talking about. But I think this is what Francis experienced too. A Jesus experience that he did not leave us a great thesis about it. He didn't theologize about it. In fact, he wouldn't even write a rule later on when they wanted him to organize his followers. No, Francis lived it. He said, no, I don't need a rule. I don't need theology. We have the gospel. I have the Jesus experience, and this is what I live. And a phrase that Richard Rohr uses, you know, he has a lot of these aphorisms that I like, because then I can hook my topics on them. You know? He has that one that we do not think our way into a new way of living, but we live our way into a new way of thinking. Well, I don't think that's ironclad. I think it's not either or, but both and. But to me, the important thing is the living out of it. I never was too great. I don't think I ever fell in love with a concept or a theological statement. In fact, I don't think I have to would ever have to do any purgatory because theology was so awful. It was so dry, and so I just remember one time the professor's going on and on about, you know, they do the thesis, antithesis, and the proof from nature and the proof from scripture, and I got called on for something. You know what I was thinking about? How I was going to rewire the workshop down in the basement. So, sorry, Father, what was that again? So I had trouble with a lot of the theory that was so dry. But I think, isn't this what happens when we don't have the experience and we just get the second, third, fourth hand description? Those are things are necessary. The analyzation and the explanation, that's all fine. But I think we need that experience. I do, anyway. And I think that's what was so great about Francis in my life. His experience, he didn't write a great deal. A few canticles and his last will and testament of the rule. Otherwise, he had the gospel. But his life is what shone forth, to me anyway. And it is a life where the experience with Jesus was a very personal one. With Claire also. You know how often, especially Claire uses her experience as mirroring God in all things. At first when I ran across that years ago, that God was mirrored in all things. They talk about seeing through the mirror. No, wait a minute. You see out of it. I don't see through it. But I think what they're talking about, the mirrors in those days were not too good. You know, they didn't have all the silvering that we use now. And so you could sort of see through it, too. I think that's what they meant. But anyway, that all creation reflected God. And they were one with this reflection, with this living with. And it is that outpouring of love, the love that reaches out to all mankind. Anyway, to me that's Francis' great insight. And later on it gets spelled out. I want to just digress a little bit here. I'm sure you ran across the name of Bonaventure and Duns Scotus and these theologians that later are trying to explain Francis' vision, to tell us something about what it meant to him and what it can mean to us. And then we also talked about the Thomistic tradition. Thomism was mainly the philosophical structure that the theology I studied was based on. Just in general, very simplified, Thomas Aquinas saw God as pure being. Creation was by the will of God. And creation was good, but in Thomas's viewpoint, it's sort of a one-time thing. God created, it was there. And as things went on, man came along and messed up that whole creation. Broke the relationship to God. So that Jesus had to come and intervene, who had to redeem mankind, to bring mankind back into union with God. And so that later on developed into the substitutionary atonement. You know, Jesus had to die, pay for our sins. Well, later on, Scotus and Bonaventure come along and they say, look what Francis gave us. That God in Francis' view was this all-giving love, this communing of sharing, this outpouring of creation. Creation and incarnation were one in their viewpoint. It wasn't a one-time act. It's a continuing, ongoing, evolving creation and incarnation. That Jesus is there from the beginning, not sent to clean up the mess mankind made of our earth. Jesus is there from the beginning as the outpouring of God's love. Well, this goes on and on. That's way oversimplified. You know, these are all nuanced to more. But at least you get an idea of what the difference was. Unfortunately, the Franciscan way of thinking about things got sort of lost. Yeah. Mainly Rome went for the more Aristotelian Thomistic approach. But now I think the Franciscan viewpoint is being reflected very much in our new cosmology and evolution, this ongoing realization that God is not everything, but God is in everything, and that we are in God. This ongoing idea that we were never separated from God. At times, as mankind in general, and we in particular, go a different way. But God is always there, always within us. But it's easier for me to talk about the way Francis saw things. Let me just read you a selection from SCOTUS, and you'll have an idea of how he approaches things. In a treatise called the Ordinatio, he writes, "If you ask whether to be is is expressible existentially of any proper concept that we can conceive of God, that is the proposition in which existence is asserted of such a concept that it is self-evident. I say no." Did you get all that? That explains it all, doesn't it? You know, even my fingers get all tangled up reading that. But, whoops. What did I knock off? Oh, it's just a cane. Good, hang on to it. Please. But coming back to Francis, you know, often he in his visions, like one of his famous visions is the cross in San Damiano, tells him, "Francis, rebuild my church." He takes it literally, and he's gathering stones, he's rebuilding. But gradually, this vision penetrates more and more deeply, and he's seeing that it has a greater meaning, rebuilding the basis of the church, living the gospel. I think that our situation today with church can be similar. The situation is not similar at all. But Francis was countercultural in his time. You know, the simple life, and his friars should not become priests. They should not be higher in any kind of hierarchical position. They should not own anything. Well, that is his countercultural reaction to the church that was at its height of political and, I guess, territorial power under Innocent III. Remember, then Rome had its own army. You know, it had the papal states. Oh, one thing I want you to keep in mind, it's in canon law at this time, especially if you're on a Mediterranean cruise. Canon law from that time said that you could be excommunicated for practicing piracy in papal waters. So be careful what you do on your cruise. So, but this is something that I guess goes on all through the history of the church. I think way back, I don't remember anybody really stating this, but I very much had the impression that the dogma of the church and the way the church is, has always been the same. You know, dogma doesn't change, the church doesn't change, it's always been that way. But if we look at history, it always changes. You know, right from the beginning. You know, the initial Jesus experience goes on for what? The next 30, 40 years after he's died? Ooh, but then what is happening? The eyewitnesses, those who have experienced Jesus, the historical Jesus who lived in Galilee and Judea, they're dying off. So somehow we have to get busy and communicate this great experience to others. So we begin with Paul. And already in Paul we can see that the paradigm, the framework in which we understand life and our relationship to God. I like that term, the paradigm. That's from Marcus Borg, about how it shifts. Very early it shifted from totally Jewish outlook to the Platonic outlook, the Greco-Roman outlook on life and their terminology, what they thought of God, of an afterlife and so on. And that continues on for centuries till you get to the Scholastic Age, Thomas Aquinas and Bonaventure, and then they have a new framework, a new paradigm with the Aristotelian philosophy on which they could hang all their theology. Again, it shifts when the Enlightenment comes along and you have the contributions of science and a new way of looking at scripture and history. And all this gets very threatening to the institutional church. You know, especially when the Reformation comes along, we can see the church pushing against reform. And nowadays, too, we can see a lot of the institutional church pushing against the reforms of Vatican II. Now, it's scary, this changing all the time, this model of the church and dogma is always being the same. Well, it's not. We understand it in different ways. And unless we get a new vision, a new way of looking at things, I think we're going to find what do they call that? You know, the major denominations are all losing members. The alumni Christians. So the people that are leaving institutional church, they've graduated. A lot of the dogma, the way it's expressed, has lost its meaning. I think worse than having anti-religion, anti-Catholicism, anti-Protestantism, is indifference. Doesn't make any difference in our lives. So what do we do? Yes, we have to find a new paradigm, a new way of looking at things. The problem with that comes along when we start changing and throwing things out. I heard a good phrase. Somebody said, be careful. When you throw out the packaging, don't throw out the contents. Yeah, so there's a content in all our dogma and all the past. We don't want to just sneer at it. You know, it's not wrong, but it can be inadequate. But all this, I think at times, it causes a lot of anxiety. I don't know about you folks, but I notice this with nieces and nephews, good people, but the faith that means so much to me just doesn't do anything. It's just indifferent. So, what do I do with that? I think it's, again, we're too much into dogma and this is how you must believe, and this is how you must be church, and this is what you must do. Got to be lived. I found this out for myself, not when it was occurring, but looking back over my life, especially when I was in the theology, and I lost my sight pretty suddenly. You know, 3-4 days, it was gone. But I was so out of it, I didn't know what was going on. But anyway, what do I do? You know, all the unchangeable things in my life, my image of myself, what I could do, what I was going to do, where I was going to go, it's all gone. I like a phrase I ran across. You know, life is what happens to you when you are busy making other plans. You know, this is not what I expected. How do I live with this? Why? Why did it happen to me? You know, over my years working with people with especially traumatic disabilities, the why is a big problem. Why me? Well, yeah, you're a human being and you're subject to all these natural laws and you were in the bad place at the bad time and so on. But it doesn't answer why. And I think that's a rather childish approach. I won't move. I won't try till you tell me why this happened. I think it works. It worked for me the other way around. First, you start to live through it. To accept, yes, this is the way I am. Now, how am I going to live through it? And I think this is where the gospel life meant so much to me, pardon me, as it did to Francis, that, like I like Matthew's phrase, Jesus says, come to me, all you who are labor and a burden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you, for I am gentle and humble of heart, and you shall find rest. Take up my cross, come and follow. And if you can, take the cross that life seems at the time. Take up that burden. You'll find out it's not such a great burden because you're in yoke with Jesus. You know, you have a harness mate. You're not alone. So over the years, that's what made a big difference for me. What's her name? Paula Darcy has that little phrase I like. God comes to us, disguises our life. I like that. How often? It's the life we have right here and now, and living it is what's going to bring us into a Jesus experience. Yeah, but how do you get this? How do you get to this place? It's not easy. It takes a lot of prayer, a lot of practice. Another one of Richard's aphorisms, well, really it's from the Talmud. We do not see things as they are. We see things as we are. Now, just a physical example of what that means. Years ago, Nancy and I were on a tour in Italy, and Nancy loves art, so we're going through the art museums in Florence. And I think the 23rd and a half museum we're going through, I could make out a little bit more in those. I could sort of see these dark blobs on the wall. And we're going along. And all of a sudden I noticed something. My golly, look, what is that? What a painting. Say, Nancy, come here and look. This must be like a Dutch master or something. Light's just shining through. And she says, yeah, it's a window. Oops. We see things as we are, not as they are. And I think in our life journey, in our spiritual journey, that's the same. We see things as we are. We have to look for another vision. If you remember, if you use the lectionary for your cycle B, like a few Sundays ago we heard about Bartimaeus, the blind man. who heard Jesus coming by and he kept crying out to Jesus. And Jesus says, come, come. And a little phrase in there always struck me. And he threw off his cloak and he went and followed Jesus. To me, that's saying, get a new vision. Throw off the cloak, whatever covers you, protects you, you think, keeps you from moving on. No, go on. Come and follow. That's, I think, Francis' great message. It is for me. Come and follow. Live out that gospel. Well, when we think about this, how do we communicate it with others? How do we express it? There are, certain problems come up. Like, we really don't have any concept or terms that fit God. Because God is the more, the ground of being, the other, beyond any of our human concepts, notions, and yet all we have are our human visions of things, how we describe things. So we talk about God as Father, Jesus as our brother. We talk about a loving God, a God who cares about us. And as long as we keep in mind, these are metaphors. These are human explanations that are pointing beyond themselves. And we have to make sure it's a metaphor that has kept its meaning so that we know what it's pointing to. An incident that always points out to me about what happens when a metaphor is no longer pointing to the reality. We were up in Stockton and we were stopped by a big parking yard, where all the school buses were parked. And it was time to go pick up all the kiddies. So the buses are coming out of the yard, and they come down the street, and they're crossing in the street. There used to be a railroad track, but it's all been paved over. The tracks are long gone, but they never took down that sign, you know, the big cross sign about stop for the train. Every bus stopped. You know, the tracks were gone. No one knew what it was really pointing to anymore. So we got to keep our metaphors straight. We can't get them too literal. Because I think that's what a lot of the anti-theism people and atheists object to, and rightly, that, you know, our images of God, especially the old theistic way of looking at God, and, you know, the three-story universe, heaven, earth, hell, God is up there, often seen more of a judge, of somebody that you better be careful of because he's watching. That, if you've ever been in Old Mission San Miguel, above the altar they have the old painting. It's been a long time. I think it's like a triangle, the Trinity, and there's one eye looking down at you. You know what's going to happen to you? You sleep during the homily? I'm watching. So we got to keep our metaphors in what can we say. Maybe in get away from anthropomorphism where we're making God human. This is what people who object a lot of to religion have in mind. Of a God out there that sometimes, if you please him, he'll intervene. Well, I think with our new way of looking at things that means so much to me, this new cosmology, and all the evolutionary theory we have originally from Teilhard and developing, this whole idea of seeing creation, incarnation, as the continuing self-giving of God, that we are in God. Nothing we can do will bring us up to God. He's already there. What we do is open ourselves up to this love, to this being, to whatever we're going to use as a metaphor. But, you know, at one time, this brought me into a dilemma. Great, so all these theories are wonderful. I really like them. But, you know, when I pray, I don't pray to the ground of being. I don't pray to the spiritual energy of the Spirit. Come and zap me with spiritual voltage. I got to get going. These abstract concepts, how do I bring them into this personal relationship? You know, in private prayer, no problem, you know, because in meditation, I try not to just dwell on concepts, but just be in that presence. That's no problem. But in communal worship, and I think for me, the community is really necessary. So how do we pray communally? We say, oh, loving, nourishing abyss. That just doesn't do it. Or, dear more, please bring it. I haven't gotten to where I try to sort of rewrite our Sunday prayers somewhat, because they are really still stuck in the old vision, the three-story universe. We pray to the God up there to please come down and fix stuff here. I think I want to pray more like Pope Francis says, pray for the hungry, but get out there and feed them. You know, do it, live it out. That's, to me, so very important. Well, in reading this appendix, Richard came up with, you know, he likes that third reality, remember? In the paradox, it's not either or, but it's both and. And we come to a third reality to see. Where Richard talks about, we do not make God in our image and likeness, that we don't project our person onto him, it, whatever. We realize that God in self-giving love has to be, yeah, person, super person, transpersonal, but it's a giving and a receiving and a responding. And we try to describe that in the Trinity. So that we are in God's image. We are person because God has brought us into this realm, this communion, this community of being. That it isn't something we earn, not something we merit. It's something given to us. And this way, I've seen the Trinity in a different light. I don't think I ever thought a whole lot of the Trinity. It was there, yeah. I believed I didn't think too much about it until I ran across one man saying, you know, if tomorrow Rome said, we're canceling the Trinity, don't bother, would it make any difference? And I think for a long time, to me, it wouldn't, because I hadn't really thought about it. That now, for me, Spirit is that inner impulse, that call that urges me to go out for myself, the call from the future, to come and live fully human, to live this life that Jesus in the Gospel shows us, a whole new dimension to human life. How are we to live it? This is the Spirit among us, that living energy that brings Jesus alive in my life, and I think in all our lives, I hope. Jesus, the incarnate loving gift of God. Jesus among us, no longer just as a historical person that lived in Palestine, but yes, He, beyond time and space in the Christ, the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning, the end, the one who brings us into personal, interpersonal union with the Father, with one another, with Jesus. And so we can know the Father and Jesus' love for us. The being that is beyond all being, that is transpersonal, that is supernatural in a sense, he can never be encompassed. God can never be fully summed up by anything we can say. But God is all in all. God is the way Francis would pray. Oh God, who are you and who am I? Very simple, just being present. Or another one of his, my God and my all. That I, what I am is what you make me, what you give me, what you bring me. Well, that pretty much covers what I'd like to tell you. And Tom, should we take a break now? And
we've got about 12 minutes.
12 minutes. Okay. Any questions? Anything you want to say? Comments?
It's not a very profound question. My name is Annette, and I would like you to repeat that Paula Darcy quote, if you would, please.
I'm sorry, the what quote?
The Paula Darcy quote.
Oh, yeah. God comes to us disguised as our life. She's got several books on spirituality. The Gift of the Red Bird. Oh, boy, my memory's going. Anybody know her latest ones? Anyway, very impressive lady. We heard her speak with Richard in Albuquerque one New Year's conference. And what brought her? In a traffic accident, she lost her husband and her little girl. And she was hurt, but not badly, but was pregnant then. And later on, having to face the drunk driver who killed her husband and her child, and her journey through life. Very impressive. Very impressive woman. Anything else? Nobody? Good. I solved all the problems.
Keith, thank you so much. That was beautiful. This is Susan. When I entered the convent in 1964, we didn't have mirrors. We weren't allowed to have mirrors.
Yeah.
And then I read about Claire, and she seemed she had a mirror, and I thought, what happened? Why don't I get a mirror?
Good.
Well, then we finally got mirrors. No, I bring that up partly because she is often called the mirror mystic, and you mentioned her in relation to mirrors. Somewhere along the line, I read that what she's referring to may not be the lousy mirrors they had then. What she gazed at, we know, for years, was the San Damiano crucifix. And that was her mirror. She contemplated the life of Jesus that is portrayed in that act of Jesus offering his life for us. And that was really how she came to understand more deeply what was going on in her own life. So I just want to offer that because it's not so much maybe a mirror. It's what do you gaze at all the time?
Good.
No. What speaks to you the most? What do you look at? And that phrase that you have offered us, I also so believe that we don't see things as we are. We see things as, and we don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. So what we gaze at a lot really has a lot to teach us.
Thank you. Yeah, I'd never heard that interpretation. That's good.
Keith, when you mentioned, this is Tom.
Tom, yes.
When you mentioned how bored you were in the theology class, I began to sympathize. And I was just thinking, that the message you brought us about Francis, you know, wanting to do things and not so much to talk about them, is reflected in the lyrics of a wonderful song in My Fair Lady by Liza Doolittle, who's fed up with Freddie because all he does is talk.
Yeah.
She says, words, I'm so sick of words. I get words all day through, first from him, now from you. Is that all you can do? Mm-hmm. And then she launches into, don't talk of stars burning above. If you're in love, show me. Remember that? Tell me no dreams filled with desire. If you're on fire, show me. Right? Here we are together in the middle of the night. Don't talk of spring. Just hold me tight. Anyone who's ever been in love will tell you that. This is no time for a chat. Haven't your lips longed for my touch? Don't say how much. Show me. Show me. Don't talk of love lasting through time. Make me no undying vow. Show me now, she says.
Mm-hmm.
So there it is. I think that's resonate. True. That's sensate. That is not very much. You know, there was a sensate dimension to Francis, wasn't there?
Yes.
Yeah.
Very much so. Good. Thanks, Tom. I might mention something I didn't bring it up, but Don George gave me an insight into a way of dealing with what anxieties or problems or hurts or doubts called focusing. I was very impressed with that. Listened to her cassettes, so might sometime think of using that in here in Word and Life. I was very impressed with it. Good.
Hello, hey. I'm Jackie.
Jackie.
We talk quite often about God being with us and also we in God, and then we skip over the we in God part. If we are in God, what happens to God? Does he evolve when we evolve? They speak of God as being unchanging, but I think unchanging and changing at the same time. I've often wondered, what happens to God as we change?
Right. I think he does evolve, especially as we change and grow, we manifest God, we make God more visible. Yeah, some of those concepts are a little hard to grasp with our imagination. But yes, I think that's a good point. And I think some of the people in the new cosmology do speak of that. You know, and of God as suffering. God is changing. Yes, that's good.
Keith, it's Tim Jones.
Tim, good.
I struggled for years trying to understand God, and nobody, including me, can define God, you know. But and I've been called a heretic to some degree, but I don't believe that God comes down and solves our problems.
No.
I believe that his work is done through our hearts and hands. And that goes with your statement about pray for the hungry, but get out there and feed them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very much so. Yes. Francis's whole idea of doing, living it. And when little aspect that comes up. I often wondered way back, you know, Francis was not the only reformer of his time. There were several groups that wanted to live a very simple life, especially in light of the wealth and the power of Rome and the developing commercialism of the time. But the Waldensians, and I think the Little Brothers of Lyons, and quite a few of them, and they all disappeared. And what's the difference? Why did Francis' movement keep going? I think one thing is that all the others attacked. You know, they lambasted Rome and got very negative. Francis never seems to have done that. You know, if Rome wanted him to do something he didn't want to do, he just walked away. You know, very quietly. It's like, who told me that? Somebody said, well, you know, you can't believe that kind of stuff. You'll be excommunicated. He said, no, you can't excommunicate me. I reject it. So there. But, you know, that ability of Francis, you know, and you know what happened later on, the order does get institutionalized. And a couple writers are saying, if it doesn't, then it just disappears. You know, oh boy, the Franciscans for, what, the 400-700 years, whatever it is, have always argued, what is poverty? And they split, I don't know how many times, like the, if you've ever been to Assisi, you notice the Franciscans that take care of the basilica, and those, they wear a black robe, black habit. They're the conventional Franciscans. They're the real liberals. They don't have the right point. That's how we used. And then there are OFMs, the big group, and then the Capuchins, and they really follow it strictly. But you know, all these different groups have all these different interpretations, and yet I think the spirit of Francis goes on. It keeps going. It sure does for me. But are we? Okay. Let's take a break and then we'll see if you have any more questions. Thank you. Oh, thank you. Great.